to the welcome back to those people who've been here in this. This is the fifth of a six-part series. There are also quite a few new faces and participants, so welcome to you as well. Okay, we'll settle down and we'll start. Plenty of room. There's a couple of seats there in the corner. Squeeze there.
Jason Johnson has a
no, because we come first into the front.
Okay, they didn't want to be blocked. So
no, she doesn't
here,
want to, she can't see.
All people have rights to.
Okay, I stand, so it shouldn't be a problem. Okay, so here we go. So this is the fifth of a six-part series. What we've been doing, just to catch you up, I mean, obviously we can't repeat everything we've been saying, but just in general what we've been doing is we've been reading rabbinic biographies. We've been trying to go through some of the classic rabbinic sources and put together profiles for some of the outstanding central rabbinic figures that populate our pages of Mishnah, Midrash, Talmud, trying to put together the image that we've been using, our portraits, literary portraits, of how these rabbinic figures, how their stories are told within classic rabbinic texts. What kind of mark have they left in this collective memory that's kind of formulated, that's crystallized in our rabbinic classical rabbinic texts. And we've been, one of the things that I do want to restate, and we've been seeing this, I think, continuously, those of you who've been with me for the last 4 or 5 meetings, is that as we read these stories, what we discover, and I think we've been seeing this in a very, very intense way, is that as these stories are unfolding, as each rabbinic story is told, as each rabbinic portrait is painted through the rabbinic narratives, what we've been discovering is very, very central issues, concerns, questions of the rabbinic world are rising to the surface, are unfolding, are being grappled with through the stories of individual rabbinic figures. I'd almost maybe perhaps suggest that as they're painting these portraits, as they're telling these stories, it's really, to a large extent, their own story that's being revealed. They're really painting their own portrait through the images of each individual story, each individual rabbinic figure whose portrait is being portrayed. And what we're beginning to discover in time, and week after week, right, personality after personality, I think what we've been discovering are some of the deep concerns, the deep debates, the deep questions, the deep dilemmas of the rabbinic world. And they're sharing with us through these narratives, they're sharing with us some very deeply revealing and sometimes very honest, sometimes painfully honest, depictions of themselves, of the choices that they've made, of the prices that they've paid for those choices, of the some of the issues that they grapple with on to create the world that we know as the Talmudic world, as the rabbinic world. And each individual rabbi highlights a particular aspect, a particular angle, a particular issue that is being worked out and dealt with and grappled with and shared with us through these stories. Now, tonight will definitely not be an exception. If anything, it might be the most intense example of what I've just been describing. Tonight, we read the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. We will read the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. We'll attempt to look at how this man, who is a very dominant personality within the rabbinic pantheon, right? The image of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, very rare to read a chapter of Mishnah, a sequence of pages of Talmud without coming across Rabbi Shimon. Right? Whenever you come across, by the way, the name Rabbi Shimon, even if there's no Bar Yochai attached to it, it's this Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So the Rabbi Shimon of the Mishnah that you come across so often, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in the Talmud, wherever you come across him, it's this man. So he's a very central rabbinic character. In terms of our timeline, I just want to remind again those of you, especially who've been here throughout, we started with the post-destruction generation, the generation of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's students. We moved to Rabbi Akiva, right, who lived through the Bar Kochba revolt, and his story was so much involved with those events. We are now moving on a generation ahead to his student, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is now the generation after Rabbi Akiva. And it's his story that we're going to read tonight, or part of his story. Obviously, the other consistent thing that has been always is that an hour and 15 minutes is by no means enough time to read a full comprehensive image, portrait, presentation of any one of these rabbinic figures. And what we've been trying to do is trace some of the major themes that their central stories seem to be highlighting and seem to be spotlighting. And each individual rabbi seems to be spotlighting another issue, another dilemma, another debate, right? And Rabbi Shimon Bar, from within the rabbinic world, and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, as I said before, is no exception. If anything, we will see that his story will spotlight an issue that the rabbis are grappling with, and in many senses, the Jewish world is grappling with to this very day. I think that was true consistently. All of the issues that were coming to the surface are ones that we can still identify with till this very day. Do you want to comment or ask?
Do you think they were selected because to highlight a special angle of the rabbinic
community? I think it's probably a combination of their historical figure. The historical figure is being sort of harnessed, as often is within cultural stories, is being sort of adopted, is being enlisted to, as we tell the historical story of this man, he comes to take on a particular shading, a particular coloring, a particular presentation, a particular depiction of something that we're very concerned with. And so that at some point I think it's hard to begin to distinguish between the historical figure and what he comes to represent within the rabbinic world, so that his narratives and our narratives about him are wrapped up with what he represents in our world and how his story is a representation of our story, highlighting a specific issue and is particularly specific, and that again will be immediately apparent with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So let's begin, because I know we always run out of time. So and at this point, I still feel like I have all the time in the world, but I know that will not continue to be the case. So let's start. Let's start our introduction to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And hopefully we'll have a little bit of time at the very, very end for me to say something about the character of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the particular figure of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who is unique in this series. Because I believe we will be able to note that something very interesting happens to the character of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. I believe he continues to develop even after the completion of the Talmudic period. Right? And we'll talk about it. In that sense, he's different than many of the other characters here. And hopefully we'll have a little bit of time at the very end to also note something about that. Let's start. Let's start with our first introduction to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai will be through a Tanaitic text brought in the Gemara in Masechet Brachot, where Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai will be represented in a very, very intense way to represent something that I think will carry throughout the stories we will read about him. Okay, so here we are. We're in the Gemara in Brachot. We're reading a Braita, a Tanaitic source. Our rabbis taught, "And you shall gather in your corn." The pasuk, of course, is Ve'asafta deganecha, which many of us recognize as being very familiar because it's integrated into the psukim of the Shema that we say as part of our liturgical services, right? As part of the Kriyat Shema and Tefillah, right? Vayayin shamo tishmeu el mitzvotai asher anochi mitzvei etchem hayom. If you listen to the words of God, etc., etc. One of the graces, right, the blessings that God blesses us with is that we shall gather in our corn. Ve'asafta diganecha. So the writer begins with directing our attention to that verse. V'asafta deganecha matamud lomar. What is that teaching us? What is to be learned from these words? And the writer continues, well, since it says elsewhere in the book of Joshua that the book of the law, right, lo sefer haTorah, shall never depart from your mouth. Lo yamush sefer haTorah hazeh mipicha. It says at the very beginning of the book of Joshua, the words of the Torah shall never depart from your mouth. I might think that that is to be taken literally, i.e. one should continuously occupy oneself uninterruptedly, if that's such a word, with the words of Torah. It should never depart from your mouth. Now, I might think that that is meant to be taken literally. Therefore, it says, thou shalt gather in thy corn, v'asafta deganecha, which implies that you are to conduct yourself with them, the words of the Torah, in the way of the world. This is the view of Rabbi Ishmael. If we were reading the original, your ear might catch a very familiar kind of a phrase, because Rabbi Ishmael here uses the term Hanheg Bahen Minhag Derech Eretz. That actually the words of the book of Joshua, Lo Yamush Sefer HaTorah Zeh Mipicha, these words shall not depart from your mouth, is not to be taken literally. That doesn't mean that really, 24/7, one should be continuously occupied with the words of the Torah. That's balanced by Vasafta Diganecha. You also have to harvest your corn. And you have to balance between your occupation with Torah and the way of the world, as Rabbi Ishmael calls it, Derech Eretz. And somehow you have to find a balance between gathering the corn, planting the seeds, plowing the fields, right? That's reverse order. Plowing the fields, planting the seeds, harvesting the crop, and keeping your occupation with the world. Well, that's Rabbi Ishmael's vision. This vision, by the way, has a long history following this Braita, of course. Adopted almost literally, Torah im Derech Eretz. Right, much later on in Jewish history, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in the 19th century Germany is going to talk about balancing Torah with Derech Eretz, inspiring then on a more personal note, right, Torah ve'avodah. Right, I grew up in the Bnei Akiva youth movement. This was our primary text, okay? This is the vision, this is the ideal, this is the model, balancing Torah with Derech Eretz, Torah with avodah, and the land, right, the agriculture. This was the image of the original image, right, of the Zionist youth, the kibbutzim of the Zionist, of the religious Zionist movement, okay? Of somehow balancing, somehow containing both. That is the vision of Rabbi Ishmael. Almost humorously, as an aside, given that this was our primary text, I said, someone once said to us, actually, since we're such avid followers of Rabbi Ishmael, this youth movement should actually probably have named itself Bnei Ishmael, not Bnei Akiva. But it sounds very odd to have a religious Zionist movement called Bnei Ishmael. But it's true. It's true. That is the ideal that Rabbi Ishmael is portraying in this Braita. Okay, many of us identify, probably many of the people sitting in this room identify with the vision of Rabbi Ishmael. However, he is not the only rabbinic opinion to be recorded in this Braita. And here we come to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai responded to this and said, is that possible? Hanheg bahem min hag derech eretz? Balancing, combining, gathering corn and studying Torah? If a man plows in the plowing season, and sows in the sowing season, and reaps in the reaping season, and threshes in the threshing season, and winnows in the season of wind, what is to become of Torah? Right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai points out a fact that many of us, I think, probably sitting in this room know, that the derech eretz, the way of the world, has a very persistent quality of being extremely time-consuming. Being time-consuming, the way of the world, is very time-consuming, and you tend to get swept up in it. And if you indeed gather in your corn with all of that's required to gather in your corn, what happens to Lo Yamush Sefer HaTorah Zeh Mipicha? All right, so Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is now responding to Rabbi Ishmael, and he's saying it just doesn't work. Rather, here's my dream. Here's my vision. When Israel performed the work of the omnipresent, I think the translator chose omnipresent because in the original it's makom, right? God's it's the reference to God is makom. An interesting choice. Shisrael osim ritzono shel makom. When Israel do the work of the will of God, their work is performed by others. As it says in the book of Isaiah, strangers shall stand and feed your flocks. That's the vision, that's the messianic vision. Israel will perform the work of God, the will of God, and others will do their physical labor for them. Interesting, nachon? And when Israel do not perform the will of God, their work is carried out by themselves, as it is said, v'asafta diganecha. Now here I'll pause for a minute, because Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai has just done a very radical rereading of that verse. Because as I cited before, everyone who reads this Braita clearly remembers this, or knows this very well. Certainly Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai knows it. That the original context in which this verse, Asafta Diganecha, is not when we do not perform the will of God. It's actually contextualized as V'hayayim shamoa tishme'u el mitzvotai. As V'asafta Diganecha, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is ignoring that. He's twisting this around. He's saying, no, when we do the will of God, then we don't have to do it ourselves. It's done for us. By the way, he doesn't tell us who these others are. Who are the others that do your work when you are doing busy doing the will of God? And I think there are a number of suggestions that we can immediately think of.
Women.
Oh, it's interesting. There's always someone who says women. What? Remember that comment, because when we continue Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's story, we'll see something about that. Women is one possibility. The other obvious candidate is? What?
Like tax paying,
okay, that's, yeah, we're getting really swept up with contemporary
Arabs. The nations of the world.
Oh, the nations of the world. Those are, okay, all kinds of others. Nachon, the nations of the world, presumably Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai might also be referring to them. In my ideal world, Israel is occupied with Torah, and the nations of the world's occupation is to provide Israel with their physical needs, with everything they need to do. That's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's image as he's portraying it here. And only when we don't do the will of God do we have to do our own work ourselves. And even worse, he continues and says, nor is this all, but the work of others will also be done by them. In other words, by Israel. If Israel do not do the will of God, then not only are we saddled with our own physical labor, but we also have to serve others. All right? Now, many commentators have spent a lot of time trying to figure out how Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai could possibly think he could get away with recontextualizing Ve'asafta deganecha this way, and a lot of creative energy has gone into trying to do this, but I do still want to, for a moment, set that aside, and I just want to listen, however, to the vision of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. What is he aspiring to? He is aspiring to an exclusive devotion. Lo yamush sefer ha-Torah hazeh mipicha, literally. That is the vision. That is what we should all be devoted to be doing, and everything else will take care of itself, right? Through others.
Did he have a profession? I know a lot of these rabbinim did.
Not that I know of, right? And soon we'll see, as historian, many of you already know, that his story really will be the story of this ideal, okay? Which leads us to a comment that the Talmud Bavli, at the tail end of depicting this machloket, very basic machloket about the world, about life, about how Torah is to be integrated into the world between Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Abaye, right, the famous Abaye, makes the following observation at the very end of this braita, brought by the Talmud Bavli. Said Abaye, many have followed the words of Rabbi Ishmael and were successful. This balancing Torah derech Eretz, in spite of the critique of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that it's impossible that you'll get swept away by derech Eretz, you won't be able to manage to somehow hold on to Torah as well. Abaye testifies, generations later, he's testifying, you know what, looking back in history, over generations, I can tell you that many followed Rabbi Ishmael and were successful. Others, maybe as many, maybe not, have attempted to follow the Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai model and were not successful. What Abaye doesn't tell us is what precisely he means by not successful. Is it that they somehow, nobody stepped up to provide them with their physical needs, so they ended up devoting themselves to Torah and yet it didn't happen? Or their Torah somehow was unsuccessful? He's not very explicit about what he means, but his observation is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai does not seem to have been successful in gathering around him many multitudes of followers who were able and capable and successful in integrating his model into the world, whereas Rabbi Ishmael was. Right? We'll see more about that in a moment. A second scenario that I want to just share with you is again a very famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which seems to me to be in some kind of dialogue or some kind of conversation with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai that we're just beginning to get a sense of. Rabbi Shimon said, as I said before, sometimes Rabbi Shimon, often Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is referred to as simply Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon said, when walking on the road and studying, of course, right? You're walking on the road. What else are you doing? Of course you're studying with you. Because lo yamush sefer ha-Torah ze mipicha.
On his phone.
Obviously. When walking on the road and studying, if one interrupts one's learning and says, how fine is this tree? Mana e ilanze. Or how fine is this plowed field? Mana e nirze. Right? If you interrupt your study even for a moment, to admire the world around you, the physical world around you, Scripture considers him as if he was liable with his life. That interruption, that momentary interruption, that distraction, the world is a very distracting place. And it is precisely that distraction that has to be struggled against, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says. And if you stop your learning even for a moment to say, Mana'e Lanze, you have just been committed an act for which you are liable to pay with your very life. He doesn't bring one. His proof text is brief, but it's consistent.
It's consistent, but there's no suggestion that...
In this particular text, no. I would say maybe it's Lo Yamosh, that's not the Torah
that there's no penalty there.
Okay, said, why? Where do we come with the severity of what he's saying? The severity of what he's saying? Okay, we'll see. We'll see as we build up. He's a very, very intense fellow. All right, that's pretty clear. That's pretty clear right now. There's no kind of middle ground, it seems, with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It's all or nothing. And nothing is absolute nothing, as is apparent here. Okay, if it's not all, it's nothing. Okay, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, I believe, is aware, right, of the fact that the message that he's portraying and the model that he's representing is in fact a very difficult one to follow, as Abaye observed. It is not one that the masses seem to be able to adopt and successfully emulate, right? And a reflection of that is in yet a third source. We're heading towards source four. Source four is by far the longest and the one where we can spend most of our time this evening, but we're building up slowly some of the pieces to bring with us to the story, to the major story, the most famous story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which we're getting to in source four. But first, source three. An observation that is attributed to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which is again a reflection, an echo, or a foretelling of Abaye's observation. Chizkia further stated in the name of Rabbi Yirmiah, who said it in the name of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, I have seen the sons of heaven, and they are but few. The phrase used in the original is Bnei Aliyah, which is translated here, sons of heaven. I mean, I guess it's an okay translation. I'm not sure I have a much better one. I maybe say those who ascend, Aliyah. Okay? I have seen those who ascend to heaven, to the heights, to the heights that one can possibly reach, those spiritual, maybe perhaps, heights, intellectual heights. I've seen them, but they are indeed few. If there be 1,000, I and my sons are for sure amongst them. If 100, I and my son and my son are among them. And if there are only 2, which there might be, it's me and my son. Well, he's clear to him, and what I think we're hearing, and we'll hear this again about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, we've heard it before, and from Abaye's perspective, here Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai himself is saying, I know there are not many who could join this exclusive group, who will be those who ascend as high as possibly, as possible, but there are very few. It might even be that it's just me and my son. We'll hear more about his son coming up. Okay, given all of that will serve as the initial brush strokes, right? The first tones, that drawing, that sketch, that impression that we're going to take with us as we read what is, again, one of the famous stories of the Talmud Bavli. I think over the course of the last couple of weeks we've read is a significant number of the most famous, maybe, Talmudic narratives. They are almost always wrapped up with some of those central rabbinic characters. And this is a very famous story. However, many times people read this story in a more revised edition, right? In a briefer form and shape. And I'd like us to read together in its original form. It's complete, the unrevised, okay? The complete and unabridged version of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave, as many of us already have the image of him. And let's start and see. Okay, we're in the Gemara Masechet Shabbat. I will later mention the context in which the Talmud Bavli is inspired to bring this story. Just very briefly now, I'll say we're in the second chapter of Masechet Shabbat. The second chapter of Masechet Shabbat has the advantage of being familiar to some of us because of the practice in some communities to recite the Mishnayot of the second chapter of Shabbat during the services, the Friday night services. It's the chapter that begins with discussing the candle lighting, lighting candles before Shabbat. It drifts into all kinds of topics, and amongst others, towards the end of the chapter, the Gemara, upon discussing the Mishnah, brings the following story. Again, I will mention again what the immediate context is at the completion of the story. The story is a self-contained unit, though. It pre-existed the Talmud. The Talmud's editor is taking this story and inserting it in a particular context, but we can read it as a text that stands in and of itself, as it did, presumably, even before the editing of the Talmud Bavli itself. Here we go. For Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon, were sitting, and Yehuda, a son of proselytes, was sitting near them. Okay. As the narrative begins the curtain rises, and the stage setting is very clear. We don't really know where we are located, but we see, right, the setting of the characters is very clearly depicted. We have a trio of rabbis, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon, who are sitting. And Yehuda ben Girim, Yehuda the son of proselytes, is sitting nearby. Now, already the stage setting raises the question, is Yehuda ben Girim, this fourth person, is he part of their group or is he not part of their group? Okay? His physical positioning seems to suggest, well, maybe he is and maybe he isn't. We don't really know. Right? Do they know he's there? He's clearly separated. He's not a rabbi. He doesn't have a rabbinic title. His name is also very interesting. He's Yehuda, okay? The son of Gerim, okay? The son of proselytes. Which also, his name itself raises a very similar question. Is he part of them or not part of them? Does he belong or doesn't he belong? Well, he belongs. He's Yehuda, right? So he belongs to their collective sort of experience or community. But he's the son of proselytes. Does he really belong? Or how long has he belonged? Or how much does he belong? So a lot of questions, I think, in the initial reading of that first paragraph has to do with insiders and outsiders, belonging and not belonging. Who belongs to the community? Who's part of the community? Who's not part of the community? And just to set that out there broadly. By the rabbinic times already, sort of within, then a ger is already a proselyte. In biblical times, you're correct. But I think by the time this narrative is being constructed, ger is usually considered to be. But you know what? Even that's an interesting possibility. Is he the Yehuda, the son of strangers, which is also an interesting possibility. Okay. All of that is just, of course, the immediate scene that hits our eyes when the narrative begins. But in a moment, the speaking is going to begin, and that, of course, is usually also when we're observing a drama. That's when our interest starts being engaged. Rabbi Yehuda commenced the discussion by observing, "How fine are the works of this people! Kama na'im ma'asehen, the actions, the deeds of these people." Now, if I was to stop here, as I just did, and think in the context of a rabbinic story, in the context of a Talmudic story, when a rabbi begins a statement by how fine are the actions of this people, if we're anticipating who is he talking about, who is this people, this nation that he's about to praise, well, I think many of us, our first guess would be, well, of course he's going to praise the Jewish people. Who else does a rabbi praise? Okay. And yet, when he continues, we very quickly understand that we're mistaken. He continues, "They've made streets. They've built bridges. They have erected baths." And we now, without it being told, we recognize exactly who he's talking about. Who is he talking about? One of the Romans. And here's this rabbinic figure who's beginning the conversation by saying, "Look how magnificent. Look how na'e." Right? Kama na'im ma'asehem shel umah zo.
Didn't they have to be very careful about what they were saying?
Well, yes. Right now it sounds like it's still... first of all, yes, as we'll soon see. But right now Rabbi Yehuda doesn't seem to be very careful. Very, he's saying something positive, no?
Oh, I know, but that's what I mean.
Do we believe him?
Yeah.
Is this just a way? Here, you're skeptical about the integrity. Is he speaking honestly?
Yeah, honestly. Yeah.
Okay, that's an interesting observation. But let's just say, even if he's not telling the whole truth, what he says about the Romans, I think all of us recognize immediately is absolutely true. If there's anything that the Roman civilization, that the Roman Empire was excellent at, excelled at, as is apparent even to this very day, is precisely their road building, their bathhouse building, and their marketplace, their commerce, their development that was really what the Roman Empire was excelled at. So he was careful in his choice. In other words, even if he didn't tell the whole truth of what he thought about the Romans, what he said does seem to have substance to it. So he tells us, now again, I want to put this back. We mentioned this very briefly, but I want to put this back in a historical context. If this is taking place here, we're in the very aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt. So when we put this in context, who is this nation? Not only is it not the Jewish nation that he's praising, it's the Romans, but it's the same Romans who just a generation or two before have destroyed the temple, just very, very recently have once again quelled this revolt, spilled so much blood, destroyed so much of this country, that the astonishment, or the, I would almost say even maybe the shock of hearing Rabbi Yehuda admire them, I don't know what the counterpart to it in modern history would be. I'm very tempted to say it would be like saying, you know, a number of decades ago, how efficient these Germans are. Their train system is amazing. They are so, I mean, it just sounds like, I can't even say the words because I get so uncomfortable. Maybe that gives us a bit of a sense of how unprepared maybe Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon are to hear this and what's going on in Rabbi Yehuda's mind. How could he possibly do this? How could he possibly say this? But he is praising the Romans for what the Romans do very well. Okay. Rabbi Yossi was silent. Okay, silent. Sorry.
This would be important from a historical point of view. It's still in the time of the Hadrianic persecutions, which happened right after Bar Kokhba revolt. But a little bit after that, the Romans got...
Calmed down.
Okay. Exactly.
All right, so we're on a border. Okay, so depending on where we're sliding this on the historical scale, is this already an indication where we begin to see... All of that would color this in different shades and colors, and thank you, absolutely. Rabbi Yossi's silent, right? Silence is either a very powerful statement, or it's an absolute abstaining of, I'm not getting involved in this, maybe for reasons that will soon be seen, as you've already mentioned. In any case, Rabbi Shimon is not silent, right? Rabbi Shimon responded, Bar Yochai responded and said, all that they made for themselves. They build marketplaces to sit harlots in them. Baths to pamper themselves, to rejuvenate themselves is the translation here, but if you look at the original, I think pamper themselves is a better translation. The bridges are merely there so that they can collect taxes from people who want to cross those bridges. You're admiring Roman accomplishments? Everything they do for the lowest possible, most self-centered possible motives. And those motives are not ones that I can bring myself to admire. There's nothing spiritually of value, nothing of content, nothing of intellectually, spiritually, nothing that I can admire. Everything that they've accomplished for the lowest possible standards of, I can't admire anything. Now, the story continues. Yehuda, the son of proselytes. Remember him? Mm-hmm. He was sitting. Do they even know he's there? I don't know. He went and related their talk. But watch carefully how careful the narrator is, which reached the government. All right, now, let's say what he did do, what he didn't do. What didn't he do? Let's start with the. He didn't go directly to the government and tattle on them. He didn't.
He didn't keep his mouth shut.
Okay, exactly. So he retailed, you know, right? We don't know who he told this to, but he told it to someone who told it to someone who told it to someone, and the next thing you know, the Roman government has heard of this, all right? Note that, I'm careful to note it because it will be important to us later on. They decreed, the Roman government, upon hearing about this conversation, says the following, Yehuda, who exalted us, shall be exalted. Yossi, who was silent, shall be exiled to Tzipori. Shimon, who censured, shall be executed. And a death sentence, therefore, is placed on the head of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. As you say, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai wasn't careful. And here's the result. All right? He's got a death sentence, a death warrant put on his head. As most people would do under these circumstances, even Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right, is not unaware of the fact that he's just had a death sentence placed over him. And he does what most people would do under the circumstances, and that is precisely hide. You go into hiding. You flee. Now, we've all read stories of people who fled for their lives, okay? Of people who've had to go into hiding because someone was looking for them. And I want you to keep some of those stories in mind as we describe where and how Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai goes into hiding, because I think we'll hear something very different than what's usually associated with someone who's fleeing for their life. Listen carefully where he hides and how. He and his son went and hid themselves in the Beit Midrash. Okay, now, that's an interesting place to choose to hide, especially if you're Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Because on the first, you know, on first glance you'd think,
That's the first place
anybody's going to look for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Where else is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai going to be but the Beit Midrash? Now, on the other hand, we might counter that and say, but you know we all know the strategy of hiding out in plain sight. Okay, maybe it's actually one of the best places to hide because who's going to think to look for me in the most obvious place? Besides the fact that we also know, I'm kind of fond of imagining that, like many of us regarding other cultures, when the Romans will open the Beit Midrash door and see this hall full of rabbis, will they even be able to tell them apart? Okay, so you get lost, and we've all seen those movies where you get lost in the scene because everybody looks like you as well, especially to foreign eyes. So maybe it isn't as outrageous as it might sound. In any case, he hides himself in the Beit Midrash, he and his son. All right, remember his son? It was mentioned before. He goes and hides in the Beit Midrash with his son, and his wife would bring them bread and a mug of water to drink and eat, right? And they would subsist on this basic requirements provided by his wife. Remember, somebody talked about women before. Provided by the wife, a very basic needs, bread and water. That's all he requires. And he presumably is subsisting of that bread and water, isolated, hidden in the Beit Midrash, never leaving, and continuously remaining there under the threat of that outside world.
Why is his son in this?
Okay, good question. Where did his son get swept up in it? And his son will follow him throughout, right? We'll talk about that in a moment. But I want to first of all highlight, one of the things that the Talmudic narrative does not do, and usually does not do, is give us a sense of time. So we don't know how long this lasts until the next shift the next twist in the plot takes place. But presumably it sounds like there's some kind of, for some amount of time. Now, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, I want to just quickly just recapture. He's sitting in the Beit Midrash, never leaving. Of course, there's a whole threat on his life outside. All he does is sit all day in the Beit Midrash with his son, learning, presumably doing what one does in the Beit Midrash, right? Learning Torah, maybe that's why his son is there. You need a chavruta, okay? And being provided with bread and water by his wife, okay? Now that sounds...
just like what he wanted.
Exactly, right? Isn't that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's ideal vision of the world? Yisrael osim ritzono shel makom b'melachtam naset al yedei acharim. Who said what women before? There you are, there it is. His wife is providing him with everything he needs. What more does he want? So this fleeing, this escaping into the Beit Midrash, already here, and it's going to just get intensified as we continue. Already here, I'm beginning to ask myself, is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai really fleeing from or escaping to, right? And it seems like he's uncannily finds himself in this fleeing for his life. He finds himself precisely where he wanted to be all along. But that's not enough, or that's not the end. When the decree became more severe, the sense of threat from the outside world intensified. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai now moves into stage two. Even this is not yet safe. I am not yet fully removed from the world enough to be completely safe. And here stage two comes in. When the decree became more severe, he said to his son, "Women are of unstable temperament. in the original, the very well-known statement is used, Nashim datan kala alehim. Okay, which interestingly here clearly doesn't mean anything regarding their intellectual capabilities. It has something to do with their what, whatever. Something else. It's not intellectual. Women are of unstable temperament. She may be put to the torture and reveal us. We are still at risk because there's one person who knows who we are, where we are, and that's Mom, okay? And she's still in danger. And that link, that one very, very trifling link to the world is still too much. It endangers us. And here we move into step two. So they went and hid in a cave. A miracle occurred, and a carob tree and a water well were created for them. They would strip their garments and sit up to their necks in sand. They dug a hole for themselves, took off their clothes, buried themselves up to the necks in sand. The whole day they studied. I love to imagine this scene. Two talking heads. With nothing from the neck below, or everything from the neck below is just buried in sand. The whole day they studied. Now, when it was the one exception, when it was time for prayers, they robed and covered themselves, prayed, and then put, where are we, off their garments again, so that they should not wear out. That's interesting. First of all, there's an interesting aside there, so that they should not wear out. You do get the sense that they are going to spend a lot. They're not in any hurry to leave, or either they don't believe that they will be able to leave, or they're not in a hurry to leave. Now, this world, this miraculous world of the cave, this alternative universe, this alternative reality that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son have constructed for themselves, they live, exist, from the neck up, continuously occupied with Torah, subsisting on a miraculous carob tree and a source of water that too is miraculously appeared in the cave. Now, this is probably again a realization, maybe far beyond even the dreams of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, of what melachtam na'aset al yedei achirim could possibly mean, that your needs are provided by others. Here your needs are being provided miraculously. I want to pause for just a second before we move on, because I'm always very struck by the choices that the Talmudic narrative makes in these kinds of moments. A carob tree. Now, the narrator could have chosen many other fruit-producing, nutrition-producing plants. He chose a carob when he narrated this story, when he constructed this story. Well, water, of course, there's no other choice. I mean, obviously, you need water. But why a carob tree?
Said something about planting
the
next generation.
Okay, so carob trees appear in rabbinic narratives in numerous places. You're referring to one of the famous Choni HaMa'agel stories where he falls asleep for 70 years and there's that whole carob, so maybe the carob is associated with continuity, with long-term, maybe indicating how long I intend to be, something along those lines. Anything else about a carob? What strikes you about a carob?
Supposedly every seed weighs the same.
Sorry?
Supposedly every seed weighs the same.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I don't know if that's true, but it's...
For carrots. The carrot.
The weight. Interesting. I have to think about that.
That's true.
That's it. That's very interesting. Just how to play that out also is, yeah.
Is there a link between the shoresh of chavurah and korban?
Okay. So first of all, up until now we've been speaking English and reading from the English, so maybe it was less... So, but if you're reading from the original, the carob tree is a charuv, right? And I think it's hard to resist detecting that that's a very loaded shoresh, okay? It, first of all, contains the shoresh of chorban. Something of destruction, something destructive, something destructing, something destruction. What is being destroyed here? What are the seeds of destruction, if you wish, that are already visible? I think the narrator here, or potentially or possibly the narrator here, as we say often, I think, in literary analysis, is already putting that that gun in Act 1 that's going to fire by Act 3. Is it, who am I quoting? I don't even know who I'm quoting. If there's Chekhov, was it Chekhov who said? That there's a, if there's a gun in Act 1, it will fire by the end of the drama. So that chorev there, that charuv there, sorry, that chorban is already perhaps potentially there. Watch out for it. Look for it. It's going to appear again. Charuv might also play off differently. Anyone else have an association, a word association with charuv? Achereb, same thing. Sword, destruction. Somebody? Ah, that's already ignoring the chet. I want mamash the chet, the charuv.
Well, another association is that Torah leaves with Shimon bar Yochai to link the temple to Torah. And here you have a korban where... symbolizing korban, which again, Torah becoming primary.
Oh, there's still a difference between charav and korban. What is a kuf and what is a chet?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit distant. I want to just toss out there, because again, we'll see later. Chorev, okay, does chorev mean anything to anyone?
Sinai.
Chorev is one of the terms used in various texts also to refer back to Sinai. We'll also actually see an appearance of Chorev again. Is there also, again, that Chorev, Torah, receiving, Torah giving kind of a notion? I want to, for a minute, leave the word, let that for a moment settle or hover. The carob itself, I'm always struck by. What? Okay, the tree itself. Let's talk about the fruit. We're mostly interested in the fruit because that's what they're going to be eating forever.
Ingredient, because it has everything which you
okay, it's very nutritious. It's packed nutrition. Right, you walk into a natural food store, you walk into a health food store, they will tell you how carobs, okay, how nutritious carobs are.
Even to children who are very, very sick, only they can survive on
that. Okay, on the other hand, it is also maybe the ultimate no-frills fruit, okay? There's no...
taste awful.
Yes, it's dry, you've got to chew on it. It feels like you're chewing a piece of tree bark, nechon? Couldn't it have been an orange tree, or an apple tree, or a pomegranate tree? I think, again, we're painting this image of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai doesn't need anything but the packed nutrition. If he could get it in a pill form, all right, or in a tube, like, you know, like the astronaut, whatever. If there's a way of getting the nutrition, he would probably have preferred that. It's the closest you can get to just my bodily needs. Don't bother me with anything else. I don't need pleasure. I don't need any of the frills. All right. And here they are, this father and son, in this alternative reality that really does seem to be a fulfillment of what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai has been yearning for, and it looks like they're settling down to stay there for quite a long time. Until... where are we? I just lost my place. Here we are. Thus they dwelt 12 years in the cave. This is actually a deviation from the Talmudic narrative's usual practice of not telling us time. And we give a very accurate sense of time, 12 years in this cave. Okay. 12 is an interesting number. We might want to think also about the implications of their staying there for 12 years, but I want to push over ahead, forward, and maybe we'll come back to the idea of 12 a little later on. What happens after 12 years? How do they finally end up digging themselves out of this reality and changing something? What changes? So the narrator, I think here, with a masterful stroke, tells us the following. Eliyahu, Ata Eliyahu, Elijah, the prophet, came, now listen carefully, stood at the entrance to the cave and exclaimed, "Who will inform the son of Yochai that the emperor is dead and his decree is annulled?" Now, it's a masterful stroke, I think, to enlist Eliyahu here into the task for various reasons. One is, well, on the one hand, Eliyahu is the natural person to be using in many rabbinic stories and later stories. All right? Eliyahu functions as, what does he do? He's a messenger. He's always a messenger from from God. He's able to traverse, right, God, heaven and earth. He can come down to earth and deliver messages that no one else can deliver. He's also the...
I've personally found that whenever I come across the story of Eliyahu, it means someone's just had an epiphany. Someone's just realized something big and important.
Okay. So taking us... Okay, so in other words, it's the Eliyahu...
As a metaphor.
As a metaphor. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Eliyahu reminds us that the people of Israel go on.
Ah, okay. We'll talk about we're going to go back to Eliyahu in just a minute. But Eliyahu stands there. Ah, you know what? Let's do that now. So you're saying Eliyahu also reminds us that the people go on. Can you explain what you mean?
They stay with Yadu. They stay with Hashem. In spite of what all the prophets are saying, or Eliyahu himself said, these people are no good, they're rotten to the core. It's not true. There's always that Eliyahu.
Okay, that's very interesting because I think you're talking about the Eliyahu as he comes, as the shape and form that he comes to take on actually in post-biblical times. If you go back to the biblical Eliyahu, I'm not quite sure that the image of the biblical Eliyahu...
No, Eliyahu is very, very critical. And that's why he comes... I mean, he's grown into that because he was so critical. I think very similar to Bar Yochai.
I agree with you absolutely. I think Eliyahu's appearance in the story draws a parallel, as we've seen before in some of the other rabbinic stories we've been reading, between Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in the rabbinic world, is a parallel to Eliyahu in the biblical world. So much so that actually those of you, some of you might recall, that Eliyahu himself has an episode where he flees for his life. Anyone remember from whom? From Izebel. Primarily from Izebel. And he flees to the desert, and amongst other things, a miraculous tree appears with miraculous food. He's fed miraculously. He then no less than flees to, anyone remember, a cave, Horev, okay, a cave. And who drags Eliyahu out of his cave? God. Saying to him, why are you here, Eliyahu? This is not where you should be. This is not where I need you to be. You need to leave the cave and go back to the people. They need you, right? And Eliyahu there cries, but they have left the Lord, right? They've abandoned you. I alone am loyal. And the echoes here are so striking that, again, in spite of the fact that Eliyahu in many rabbinic narratives serves this function in this specific moment, sending Eliyahu to get Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai out of his cave carries such an additional level of information, irony. Of irony, but of significance, of meaning. Eliyahu comes because Eliyahu says, I've been there too. I too was in the cave. And I know why you're in the cave. I felt it too. I experienced it too. I know how difficult it is to be pulled out of the cave. By the way, I think the biblical text even suggests that Eliyahu ultimately might even have been actually unsuccessful. If you recall, when God takes him out of the cave, his task is, what he's instructed to do, is go back and anoint Elisha in his place. And it sounds like God is disappointed. And Eliyahu, almost it feels to me like Eliyahu is here to make sure that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai doesn't fail in that cave test the way he himself perhaps did. So inserting him into the story, I think, again, is a masterful stroke of rabbinic narrative.
I think there's an implication here that, as opposed to the typical story of Eliyahu that appears in rabbinic literature, where he is a messenger, that here he's not really a messenger, but he's not on a mission from God. He personally wants to look after Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. He wants to help him.
Maybe he's conflicted. Is that what you?
He doesn't come and say, "Hi, Rabbi Shimon. The king is dead. You can come out now."
Yes.
He says, "Well, I hope somebody tells him that as though he doesn't have the authority to tell him. So he's doing a trick to make sure he finds out anyway."
How interesting! How interesting! You're highlighting another decision that the narrator is making in this very dramatic moment. Eliyahu stands at the entrance to the cave. He does not go inside. Now, given what we've said about Eliyahu already, we might suspect maybe he doesn't go inside because he doesn't trust himself. Okay, the temptations of the cave are still alive, are still vivid. He can't go in because it's so powerful. So that's one explanation. And so he stands out and sort of also in this roundabout way, this indirect way, right, doesn't... But the choice to have Eliyahu approach or the message delivered, the information delivered in this indirect way without going into the cave certainly requires our attention. There are other explanations, I think, or other suggestions we can make about perhaps what it signifies that Eliyahu does not go into the cave. Maybe there's a reflection here, if we take, for instance, a different track, that he is being sent, he is a messenger of God. His refusal to enter the cave might also be a suggestion of... Yes, yes. As God's messenger, I want that cave that you've constructed, that illusion that you've created of this pure godly world, God refuses to enter, and he refuses to send his messenger inside, right? There might be overtones, as we'll soon see confirmed by the continuation of the story, possibly, as well.
Just on a more practical level, and jumping off of what Moshe said earlier, you know, The fact that Eliyahu was asking in the form of a question, who's going to tell them? Because they abandoned the only person who knew where they were.
Yeah.
I mean, unless, although I was also thinking that, like, presumably all the men in the Beit Midrash knew where they were. So either they trusted all the men not to, you know, reveal them under torture, or they were literally hiding, like, in a closet in a corner and no one else ever saw them. But here, if literally no one else knows where they are, things are going to happen in the world, and they will never find out about it.
Yes, right. So that sort of rhetorical question, it's not a rhetorical question, it's a real question, and that's an observation. There's no one left to tell you anything because you've cut all ties to the world. Okay. It's also possible, anyone of us here who might have had in their lives a cave experience where you've retreated from the world, For some amount of time.
Not voluntarily.
Either not voluntarily. Some people might voluntarily also have had that kind of experience where they've retreated from the world. Okay. Maybe Eliyahu understands, maybe from his own experience, that what's about to take place, this re-entry, is actually a very difficult. It's a very difficult moment, and it's a very difficult... Someone who's been in a cave alone with his son for 12 years, buried to his neck, I can't just barge in there and say, ta-da, I'm here, the emperor is dead, come on. You can't do that. You have to go very carefully, quietly. I'm hearing the still, small voice, maybe, of Eliyahu's own story. It has to be done gently, and maybe Eliyahu is being very sensitive here. The only way... Maybe he's also suggesting that it has to be Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's ultimately his choice to leave the cave. You can't pull someone out of the cave if they don't want to come. So I have to come as far as the entrance to the cave and stand there and trigger. Send out a trigger. You'll bite or you won't bite. You'll respond or you won't respond. It's your choice. No one else can make that choice for you. In any case, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai does respond. And the back to they emerged. Okay, they emerged. This is again one of my favorite examples of Talmudic narrative. In English, it's two words. In the original, it's one. Nafku. It's a whole. I think many modern novels would have written not a chapter, but maybe a whole book about what do you mean they emerged? Zeu? 12 years in a cave and they're now stepping out into sunlight for the first time. And you tell me one word, you capture all of that in one word, nafku? What did it feel like? What happened to their eyes? I'm just thinking, just physically, what does it feel like to have the sun on your skin for the first time in 12 years? How do your pupils dilate? How do you see I mean, there's just so much to describe of what you see. Nothing. The minimalism of the Talmudic narrative is one of the most striking artistic... Anybody who likes minimalism in art, by the way, loves Talmudic stories. Because they in just very delicate strokes, right? They give you a... So, nafku. They left. They emerged. Let's see how successful re-entry into the world is for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son. Seeing the man plowing and sowing, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes. Yeah.
They exclaimed, they forsake life eternal and engage in life temporal. I'm going to read the original for a minute. Menichin chayei olam ve'oskin b'chayei sha'a. Look at these people. They are engaged in what? In earth and what and they set aside. This is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai still speaking after 12 years in the cave. He emerges unchanged, still believing in what he believed in all along. Wherever they cast their eyes, whatever they cast their eyes upon was immediately burnt up. Right? That gaze, that rabbinic gaze of disapproval, that burns you to a crisp, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son Rabbi El, everywhere they look, what do they see? They see, right? People plowing, asafta de ganecha. And where's the loyamushtefa toaz and coming from where they're coming from? And this buildup of spiritual powers that allow them, destroys with a glance, right? Thereupon, a batkol came forth and cried out, "Have you emerged to destroy my world? Return to your cave." Now what's so striking, especially coming from where we're coming, is of course the choice here of possessive pronouns. God says, "You're coming to destroy my world? This is my world." What do you mean they are leaving, right? They are busy, occupied with my world, and go back and watch carefully. He calls it your cave. That's not my cave. This is my world, and that's your cave. Go back to your cave. I don't need you out here. And it appears that they're echoing, following the footsteps, maybe of Eliyahu's failure to fully appreciate what God really wants. He does not want prophets in caves. Nor does he want rabbis buried up to their necks in caves. Go back. So they returned and dwelt there 12 months. One additional year. 12 months, 1 month per year. Okay, a full 13th year now. Saying, the punishment of the wicked in Gehenom is limited to 12 months. That's an interesting observation. Because if previously it sounded like the cave was Gan Eden, they now realize that they have actually been banished to Gehinnom. And that's their sentence. Their sentence is a 12-month sentence. That's the maximum sentence that anybody can get in Gehinnom. Won't go into that right now. That's a rabbinic perception. In any case, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son return for yet another year. What I am very curious about, and as often is the case, the Talmudic narrator does not offer me information about, is what do they do in that last, final 13th year in the cave? Do they go back to doing what they were doing before? Do they strip naked, bury themselves in sand, and learn Torah for another 12 months? Or do they do something else? And partly that question has to do with how much have they understood? How much do they understand more and differently about the cave and the world outside and the world inside? Now, if indeed they made that observation about Gehinnom, that seems to reflect that they really do have understood.
They refer to themselves as Rishaim.
As Rishaim. Okay, all of that presumes, however, there's an ambiguity in the original Hebrew that the English translator has made a choice. It's a legitimate choice, but it is a choice. If you look back for a minute quickly with me, into the Hebrew, they go sit again for 12 months, a full year. Amrei. Mishpat Rishaim beGehinom 12 Chodesh. The key word there is Amrei. Now in Aramaic, I won't go into all the details, I see, of course, as always, our time is running out. Amrei in Aramaic could mean either saying, or it could be, as it often is, actually, in Talmudic narrative, a third voice observer saying, we say. It's an editorial comment, all right? It could be they went back saying to themselves as the narrow English translator chose to read it. It could work that way. But it could definitely be read, and personally it's my inclination to read it that way, that they go back to the cave and it's the editor telling us, it's the narrator telling it to us. Because we say the Rishaim go back to Gehinnom for 12 months. It's not necessarily yet in their consciousness. And I think that makes more sense based on the continuation of the story. Let's continue and see. A bat kol comes out and says, go forth from the cave. At the end of the year, this time, no Eliyahu, no beating around the bush, no delicacy, no... A bat kol comes out and says, leave. It's time to leave, pack up, go. They emerged This time, wherever Rabbi Elazar, now this is the first time we discover the name of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's son. Up until now he's been his son, now he's Rabbi Elazar. It's also the first time that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Elazar split and no longer function as one unit. This time, the narrator tells us, wherever Rabbi Elazar struck, Rabbi Shimon healed. When they emerge from the cave the second time, there's already a difference between the father and the son. Rabbi Shimon seems to have undergone some kind of transformation that changes his attitude. Rabbi Elazar, right, the younger of the two, is still not reconciled to this world of reality, right? And he still strikes wherever he sees. Rabbi Shimon is now healing. And he says to him, "My son, you and I are sufficient for the world." In which case, I think we now have revealed to us what Rabbi Shimon has now understood, and maybe perhaps what has happened to Rabbi Shimon and what has not yet happened to Rabbi Shimon. What's happened to Rabbi Shimon is he's reconciled at least to what? What has he reconciled himself to? Why is he healing now?
It's enough for the two of them to be fully Torah.
So I'm reconciled to the fact that the outside world is not going to follow in our model. I understand that. I can live with that. I understand now, as echoed in the previous text that we started a long time ago with, right, that you and I are enough for the world. By the way, I think there's an interplay here of a question, at least, of what world? This world? That world? The world of the cave? Right? Chaye Olam, Chaye Sha'ah. What world is it enough for you to be in? But in any case, Rabbi Shimon is not reconciled or has not changed so much his own personal ideology as much as he's reconciled to the fact that the world is not going to adopt that position. And therefore, we can't destroy the world. But we, you and I, son, need to remain loyal to what we represent in the world, and that seems to be, again, absolute devotion to Torah. That takes place, or that changes, that shifts in the following section. On the eve of the Sabbat, before sunset, they saw an old man holding two bundles of myrtle running at twilight. Okay, it's Friday, the sun is setting, we all know that feeling, right? You're running home, and they come across this old man running with two myrtle branches, bunches of myrtles in either hand. And they stop him. Well, I don't know if they stop him because he's running. Maybe they run along with him and they say, "What are those for?" And he said, "They're in honor of Shabbat." "But shouldn't one suffice?" they ask him. "Why do you need two bundles of hadassim? Why do you need two bundles of myrtles?" He responds, "One is for Zachor and one is for Shamor." One corresponds to Zachor and one corresponds to Shamor. Said Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai to his son, "See how precious are the commandments to Israel," and their minds were set at rest. Here, I think, is where is the deepest, most critical transition takes place in Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's life, and even in the life of his son as well. Here, they seem to be again as one. Something in something about this encounter with this old man running with these two myrtle branches brings about a deep transformation of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And I have to tell you that for years, I have been asking myself, what is it about this old man running with two myrtle branches in either hand that brings about this deep shift, that their minds are set at rest, that they really deeply reconcile themselves with the world as it is, and we'll soon see as we continue that the narrator narrates even more intensely how dramatic a change has Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai has undergone. What is it about this old man in the myrtles? What does he see? What do they see? So we got to do this quickly. So yeah, go throw him out.
Oh, I was going to say it's an integration of the physical and the spiritual.
Okay. Vadai. Okay. Vadai, there's that aspect. Of course, he's running with myrtle branches, and the myrtle branches are a way of expressing his devotion to Shabbat. Now, one of the interesting things that I've always been struck by is that this man is not running with anything that is actually strictly, formally a requirement of Shabbat. He's not running home with his wine to make Kiddush. He's not running home with his challah to make, right, for hamotzi. He's running with myrtle branches. You can have Shabbat without a myrtle branch. And yet he's running home with this myrtle background, the myrtle that has a smell, that's all it has. If you remember your imagery from Sukkot, that's what a hadas is. It's pure smell. There's nothing else to it. It's just that sensual enjoyment of smell, and he's running with it home so that his Shabbat home has... It's not halachic. It's not halachic devotion. It's not devotion to, strictly speaking, formal... But it's absolute, pure enjoyment. I want this. I need this in my home. And I need it to reflect also the duality of Shabbat. Zachor and Shamor.
And that he's an old man, which makes it hard for him to carry and to run. And to run. So shows his passion.
And he's able to overcome all of those limitations. Now, the Zachor and Shamor are also interesting. Because it seems to also reflect that the Jewish world, the world of Torah, is not only a world of Zachor. It's not only an intellectual world, which leads me back to think about, if I haven't already been thinking about it, all those years when Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is buried up to his neck in sand, studying Torah, what about performing the Torah? What about observing the Torah? How do you perform mitzvot when you're buried up to your neck in sand, alone in a cave? There are so many mitzvot. Now, it did emphasize that they prayed. But what about, there's so much... What? And you got dressed for that. But what about everything else? What... What about all the rest of observing Torah? What about the Shamor? And when they see this man running home with the mert, with the hadassim, saying, there's Zachor and there's Shamor, right? There is the strict legal, there's the Torah itself, but then there's living the Torah with everything, with the world, with plants, with smell, with...
From one of the other sources, it looks like Shimon didn't understand that physical pursuits don't have to be only for yourself.
Yes.
That, like, he's saying that, well, the Romans do it all for themselves. And he might have thought that this man is running home with myrtles just because he loves the smell. But this man is saying, no, it has to do with Shabbat. Like, I want to make Shabbat nicer. It's because of what things that it says in the Torah. And maybe he had a realization that maybe people use their interest in the physical world to enhance their spirituality.
Okay. Exactly. Okay? Exactly. And something very deep, all of a sudden, like, shifts in Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's mind. In his sons as well. But I do want to point out, and we have barely 5 minutes to finish all the rest of this, but I will say, at this moment, Rabbi Lazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, disappears from the story. We do not hear of him again. We do hear of him again in the Talmud. Rabbi Elazar Bar Rabbi Shimon is one of those colorful rabbinic characters. If we had a 15-part series, I'd definitely do a session on Rabbi Elazar Bar Rabbi Shimon. I will just tell you two things about him in his character as he's portrayed in other Talmudic texts. He is described later on as becoming one of the most obese rabbis. Seriously. Described, which is very interesting. If you spend your childhood eating carobs buried to your neck. The other thing that's very interesting is the Talmud tells us he becomes an informer for the Roman government. Those are two as... while maintaining a status of being a learned and rabbinic scholar that only has the respect of fascinating character, all right? As, you know, if there's anybody here in the room with any kind of, I guess, psychological background. Not surprisingly, his story turns out to be quite, quite extraordinary with this as a beginning. But from this story, he ends. We have to do this very, very quickly. We're going to have to do a little bit of skipping around. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai then goes out, and watch what a dramatic... I'm going to skip the passage where he meets Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair, who, very interesting, takes him to a bathhouse, which, of course, is very interesting given that it's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. On the other hand, it's not very surprising if you've just spent 13 years buried to the sand. He takes him to a bathhouse. He tends him. He cares for him. His body is in desperate need of attention and obviously in care. But I want to skip to the next. Do you see the paragraph that begins, since a miracle has occurred? Watch the transition that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai has undergone. Since a miracle has occurred, he said, let me go and amend something. Let me go and fix something in the world. I now understand that my task as a scholar of Torah, as a rabbinic figure, my task is not to remain buried to my neck in a cave, up to my neck in sand in a cave, but it's to go out in the world and fix things. Litaken. Letaken, of course, immediately reminds us of Takanot and Tikkun Olam, and that's what...
What is the miracle he's referring
Good question. What is the miracle he's referring to? Right? Now, the only thing that explicitly has been called a miracle so far in the story was the carob tree in the water. So maybe the miracle is his survival in the cave. But maybe the is it successfully also, of course, surviving the Roman death sentence? Maybe that's also a miracle. But maybe there's another miracle. And the miracle of change, and the miracle of transition, and the miracle of leaving the cave, maybe that's also miraculous. And he recognizes, in recognition of that miracle, or all the above, he has to fix something. And then an interesting biblical citation, for it was also said, and Yaakov came whole to the city of Shechem. Vayavo Yaakov Shalem. Nachon? That's what it says. And there's a rabbinic, by the way, the location of that story is Yaakov after meeting Esav, after successfully confronting that dreaded meeting with Esav, and Esav, of course, is, in rabbinic thought, always Rome. And Yaakov, under the same circumstances, when Yaakov emerges successfully from the encounter with Esav, he also goes to the city of Shechem, and he graces the city. And the rabbis interpreted that as meaning he was gracious to the city. Rab said he instituted coinage for them. Shmuel said he instituted markets for them. Rabbi Yochanan said he instituted baths for him.
Riches.
Okay, riches are coming up. So the Romans didn't invent baths and markets. Yaakov Avinu already graced the city with Vayichen et Pnei Ha'ir. He gifted these gifts to cities. They don't have to be, as you said before, they don't have to be harnessed for the lowest possible containers of the lowest possible. They can be imbued with spiritual values, and Yaakov Avinu did it, so can Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And he indeed goes on in the story to continue. We're running out of time. You'll have to read it yourself. But he does go on. The only thing that was missing was bridges, as somebody said here. He actually erects a bridge.
The bridges aren't really missing. He said for money. And he said the reason for the bridges is money.
But he does erect a bridge. What he ends up erecting is a halachic bridge. Interestingly enough, they tell him that there's a plot of land that is considered to be tameh. And the priests have a terrible time of it because they keep having to walk around that plot of land. And what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai does is he marks a path within that plot of land. He marks out a path that's tahor inside of all of that tum'ah, okay, so that the Kohanim no longer have to go around it but can go through it. Right? That's a very interesting image, I think, for the change that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai has undergone. If he looked at a plot of land and he said, that's safek tameh, I have to go around it, or I have to avoid it. Now what he understands is you can plant a path of tahara, of purity, within the tum'ah. And he accepts that, and he institutes that, and he takes on the responsibility as a rabbinic leader not to retreat from the world, but to trace that path of tahara within a world of safek tum'ah. The story ends dramatically with all kinds of dramas, but as always, we're short of time. Read the end of the story. There are things to think about in terms of what does Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai still hold? He's still this intense guy, okay? He's an intense guy to the very end, but his loyalties shift from being loyal to one ideal to another ideal. And it's the ideal of responsibility and social responsibility that now takes over from this ideal of exclusive devotion to Torah. Two postscripts. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai continues to grow. His story, his biography, his portrait continues to grow even after rabbinic literature has completed its depiction of him. The 13th century, a book is discovered, as many of you know, that attributes itself to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, all of a sudden, a whole new chapter of his life emerges into consciousness, and that is he becomes the author of the Zohar, and develops, therefore, within certain circles of which Kabbalah and mysticism is going to be central. His character continues to grow to this very day in Hasidic circles, in some Sephardic circles, where Kabbalah has a very... Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, anybody who's ever been in Israel around Lag BaOmer knows what goes on in Meron. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai understands that this man is still very much alive, and his character is still carrying on, taking on new meaning for people, and his story is still being written to a very large extent as people project onto him all kinds of of beliefs and ideals and intense spiritual power. The final thing that I just wanted to say is that I think, ironically, the Talmudic narrator, and with this we'll end, has done something very interesting in his story, consciously or unconsciously, as Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai raises the issue of cultures and countercultures, the world, the inside world, the outside world of Torah, and the outside world. He's drawing on an image, the Talmudic narrator, I can't help but being reminded of that cave, of an image that comes from a different culture, actually, the form, maybe perhaps, a culture that precedes the Roman culture that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is so clearly rejecting here. And I don't know how many of you have the Greek Plato's parable of the cave. There are so many striking similarities, the idea of illusion and truth and enlightenment. Where is truth, right? Where is illusion? Inside the cave, outside the cave, which is the world of absolute truth. And maybe more interesting than anything else, Plato, if you don't, are not familiar or don't remember the parable, should definitely reread it in context of this story. It seems almost as if there's a conversation going on between these two cave imageries, and specifically, what they share in common is Plato, too, talks about the responsibility of the enlightened to share their enlightenment with those that are not yet enlightened. It's a very, very strong motif in Plato's parable. It's a very strong motif in Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's story. Is this conscious or not? I don't know, but it's interesting that in a story that talks about rejecting Roman or external culture is actually seems to be in conversation with a very Greek classic is, of course, just an added perspective that you're invited to continue thinking about. I apologize for going a little bit over time, and thank you. And next week, or the last session, will be Yehuda HaNasi.
There's a conversion between the various groups and the various